terms of what I can do, because I think that had a lot to do with the huge challenges and the misperceptions and fake news. As I told to the team as I was leaving, unfortunately, in September 2016, I did not want to be a distraction. But I couldn't be more excited and happy as to the new opportunities that are not only for a number of the companies I've worked with here in Russia, but really people across the United States. I think particularly given my focus in the energy sector, the level of enthusiasm about some of the changes that are underway is really hard to overstate. According to the Steele dossier, Page is still secretly working for Trump at this point. Asked about his reasons for coming to Moscow, Page replies, "My main objective when I first moved over here in 2004 and when I've been coming back and forth throughout my life is really to have a positive impact with improving the situation with U.S.-Russia relations." Asked about A, whether he is, while in Moscow, carrying out his pre-trip plans to discuss business contracts and hold negotiations with Russian nationals, B, whether any such negotiations have been successful if already held, C, whether he has had any contact with Rosneft executives while in Moscow, and D, whether he knows who in the incoming Trump administration will be put in charge of negotiating the Ukraine crisis, Page makes reference to a just-closed deal in which Russian oil giant Rosneft sold a 19.5% stake of its ownership to a joint Swiss-Qatari venture. This is the deal the Steele dossier alleges Page helped Trump benefit from financially by means of a brokerage fee from Rosneft. Page says, "I did have the opportunity to meet with an executive from Rosneft, and I think, unfortunately, it's a great example of where the recent deal, which Glencore and Qatar were able to move forward with, was one that, unfortunately, United States actors were constrained from being part of. And I think there's a lot of ways where a lot of the impact of sanctions has really affected individuals from the U.S. side, much more so than we've seen with Russia." Page does not clarify who the United States actors are who had been hoping to profit from the Rosneft sale. As Page's questioner finishes asking him whether he has met with anyone from Rosneft and begins asking who will be handling the Ukraine crisis for the Trump administration, an unusually loud English-language Russian-accented voiceover, not native to the audio or video of the Q&A, takes over the official RT YouTube clip of the event, making it difficult to hear Page's response. The unexplained audio distortion ends 10 seconds after Page says he has met with Rosneft executives during his December trip. According to the Steele dossier, which cites a close associate of Rosneft CEO Igor Sechin, on July 7th or 8th, 2016, during one of the 2 days of his first 2016 trip to Moscow, Page speaks face-to-face with Sechin. During the conversation, Sechin allegedly tells Page that Sechin will offer Trump a brokerage windfall layered atop the upcoming Rosneft sale of a 19% stake in the company, but only if Trump agrees to lift U.S. sanctions on Russia should he become president. Per the dossier, Page expresses interest in the offer and assures Sechin that Trump will end all sanctions on Russia if elected. The dossier adds that Sechin later reports to his associate that while Page never said so explicitly, he feels that Page does speak with the Republican candidate's authority. 5 months later, in December 2016, Page is once again in Moscow as the Rosneft deal, Russia's largest ever oil deal, closes. Rosneft sells a 19.5% stake in the company for $10.2 billion. The purchasers of the stake in a 50-50 venture are Swiss oil trading firm Glencore and the Qatar Investment Authority, QIA. As the transition team does its work in December 2016, a small, if overlapping, group of additional Trump aides, associates, and allies, including Michael Flynn, Tom Barrack, Rick Gates, and Bud McFarlane, do a different sort of work. They lobby Trump to give nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia so that Russian companies and others can get billions of dollars in contracts to build nuclear reactors in the Middle East. The proposal would require lifting sanctions on Russia, according to Reuters, to allow currently sanctioned Russian companies to partner with American entities to build reactors in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The latter nation, too, because under the terms of a deal signed many years ago by the United States, if the American government relaxes nuclear weapon safeguards on Saudi Arabia, a gold standard clause from a past U.S.-UAE nuclear deal would ultimately entitle the UAE to enrich uranium as well. As explained by ProPublica, Saudi Arabia needs approval from the U.S. in order to receive sensitive American technology. Past negotiations broke down because the Saudi government wouldn't commit to certain safeguards against eventually using the technology for weapons. Now the Trump administration has reopened those talks and might not insist on the same precautions. On December 15th, Jared Kushner, Michael Flynn, Steve Bannon, George Nader, and the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, Mohammed bin Zayed, MBZ, meet secretly at Trump Tower. Kushner never discloses the meeting on his SF-86 federal security clearance form, and MBZ breaches diplomatic protocol by not alerting the Obama administration to his presence in the United States. Over the next few months, Nader will come to the White House several times to meet with administration officials, and one of these times, he will bring Joel Zammel, who was present at the August 3, 2016 meeting Nader had with Donald Trump Jr., and meet with Bannon and Kushner. After the December 15, 2016 meeting, Eric Prince reaches out to MBZ on behalf of Trump and asks him to set up a back-channel meeting with a close Putin associate. According to ABC News, Prince contacted MBZ through an agent of his, Nader, and Nader thereafter set up a January 2017 meeting between Prince and Kirill Dmitriev of the Russian Direct Investment Fund, RDIF. Leon Black, a friend of Jared Kushner's with whom he was spotted at the U.S. Open just a few months before the 2016 election, is both the CEO of Apollo Global Management, which in 2017 will loan Kushner $184 million, and an RDIF board member. The parent company of the RDIF is VEB, the same sanctioned Russian bank whose chief executive Kushner had just met with a few weeks earlier. ABC News will report in August 2018 that Special Counsel Robert Mueller has now accessed Eric Prince's phone and computer. This is a sign, says ABC, that Mueller could try to squeeze Prince, as he has others, probing potential inconsistencies in his sworn testimony. According to ABC, earlier this year, Mueller obtained evidence that calls Prince's testimony into question. Lebanese-American businessman George Nader, a key witness given limited immunity by Mueller, told investigators that he set up the meeting in the Seychelles between Prince and Dmitriev. Also, before and after Prince met Nader in New York a week before the trip, Nader shared information with Prince about Dmitriev. ABC suggests that Prince could therefore be in legal jeopardy, not just because of his testimony about Dmitriev, about whom he indicated to Congress he knew virtually nothing when he met him, but also because of other statements he made under oath that also appear to be untrue, including his claim he has zero investments or business partnerships with Russian nationals. According to ABC, multiple Prince associates have been contacted by Special Counsel Mueller and have told Mueller's investigators of Prince's partnership through his Frontier Services Group with Dmitry Strashinsky, a former Russian Special Forces soldier turned arms dealer and manufacturer. ABC says Strashinsky acted as Prince's partner in an effort to secure a possibly illegal private security contract with Azerbaijan. For the proposed contract, named Project Zulu, Prince and Strashinsky, a dual Russian-Israeli citizen, each stood to make $21 million, or 20%, of the proposed $216 million deal. ABC also found evidence that Prince dealt with the Russian state-owned energy firm Rostec. According to a former associate of Prince, Rostec asked Prince's Frontier Services Group to work on logistics for a proposed refinery operation in Tanzania and Uganda. Work began, the associates said, but the deal fell through when the United States imposed sanctions on the Kremlin-run firm in 2014. The associates said there was no business because the deals weren't finalized, but Prince provided manpower and resources in both projects. Prince thus joins Flynn as another shadow national security advisor to Trump, who discussed sanctions with a Russian national during the presidential transition, a fact he failed to disclose and indeed misled investigators about. And Prince stood to benefit personally if Russian sanctions were lifted. Like Flynn, who met with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak before as well as after the election, Prince met with foreign nationals both before and after Election Day who were in a position to assist him in securing business deals with the Russians going forward as long as Trump ended U.S. sanctions on Russia. Michael Flynn's first recorded payment as a lobbyist working to convince the U.S. government to sell nuclear reactors to Saudi Arabia came in 2014 from a company called ACU Strategic Partners. By 2015, he was partnering in his lobbying effort with the British-American Alex Copson, who was telling people he had a group of U.S., European, Arab, and Russian companies that would build as many as 40 nuclear reactors in Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, in his role with ACU, Flynn flew to Egypt in 2015 to convince officials there to hold off on a Russian offer to build nuclear power plants. Given the association between Flynn and George Papadopoulos, it is noteworthy that just 2 months before the 2016 presidential election, Papadopoulos was in New York City arranging a meeting between Trump and President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi of Egypt. Papadopoulos' academic specialization, one that dovetails with Flynn's lobbying interests as well as with the general-turned-lobbyist's own interest in Egypt, is Middle Eastern energy issues. By 2016, Flynn's lobbying efforts had transitioned into new entities and partnerships, and he was working with Bud McFarlane in a new iteration of ACU called IP3 International. By early 2017, Tom Barrack had joined them in lobbying Trump to sell nuclear technology to the Saudis. Jared Kushner's activities in 2016 and 2017 suggest an alignment between his business and professional interests and those of Flynn, McFarlane, Prince, Barrack, and Papadopoulos. In October 2017, Kushner will take a sudden trip to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, where, according to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Kushner discusses the names of Saudis disloyal to the Crown Prince, including highly classified information from his father-in-law's President's Daily Brief, PDB. Soon after, the Crown Prince tells friends that Kushner is in his pocket. Kushner is said to regularly use WhatsApp Messenger, an encrypted messaging app for smartphones, to text the Crown Prince against the advice of his attorneys and in possible violation of the Presidential Records Act. His use of WhatsApp means his communications with a Saudi Arabian prince are likely invisible to outside requests for review. In early November 2017, Kushner advises his father-in-law to support Saudi Arabia's blockade of Qatar, one of Trump's only advisors to do so. According to NBC News, some top Qatari government officials believe the White House's position on the blockade may have been a form of retaliation driven by Kushner, who was sour about the failed December 2016 deal with the QIA to save his property at 666 Fifth Avenue in New York City with a massive investment from Qatar. Later that month, Leon Black's Apollo Global Management, one of whose largest investors is the QIA, lends Kushner $184 million after Apollo co-founder Joshua Harris has several meetings with Kushner in the White House. According to the New York Times in February 2018, even by the standards of Apollo, one of the world's largest private equity firms, the previously unreported transaction with the Kushners was a big deal. It was triple the size of the average property loan made by Apollo's real estate lending arm, and one of the largest loans Kushner companies received in 2017. The concurrence of all these events raises the suspicion among several media outlets that Kushner has used his father-in-law's support of the Saudi blockade of Qatar to squeeze the Qataris for money. As Vanity Fair will sarcastically observe, there's no way to know whether the Trump administration's decision to rain hell on Qatar was the result of Jared not getting his way. Certainly, neither the Kushners nor the Trumps are known for holding grudges or for retaliating against people they believe have wronged them. But the timing is interesting. One could almost say a pattern is emerging. In August 2018, a QIA-backed firm loans Kushner money again when a company the QIA partly owns, Brookfield Asset Management, invests $700 million in the Kushner-held property at 666 Fifth Avenue, thereby allowing Kushner to pay off the entirety of the debt owed on it. According to Slate, because the QIA was one of the two purchasers of the 19.5% stake in Rosneft discussed in the Steele dossier, Special Counsel Mueller is now investigating all QIA-Kushner transactions. The stories of Kushner's loans line up remarkably well with one of the Steele dossier's core allegations of Russian bribery, writes Slate. News stories suggest that Kushner may have orchestrated a foreign policy crisis to pressure Qatar to bail him out. Months later, a firm linked to Qatar gave him a staggeringly large loan. All of these events suggest how Russia might have delivered a possible quid, a potential payment from a huge oil sale through back channels, a QIA-connected loan to Kushner, in return for a Trump administration quo, a reported promise of reduced sanctions on Russia. Importantly, Saudi Arabia's blockade of Qatar began in June 2017. The Qataris loaned Kushner money almost immediately after Trump, on Kushner's advice, tweeted that he supported the blockade in November 2017. Should Kushner not be required to pay back any portion of the $884 million loaned to him in total by the two QIA-linked outfits, it could constitute the brokerage of the QIA-Glencore purchase of $10.2 billion in Rosneft that Sechin promised Trump. Trump's lifting of sanctions on Rosneft, his intended plan upon entering the White House, as has since been reported, would so substantially raise Rosneft's profits that any such brokerage would be worth it for the Qataris. For instance, if U.S. sanctions on Russia are dropped, ExxonMobil can once again partner with Rosneft in the world's northernmost oil field, the Pobeda, Victory Field. A 2012 deal between Exxon and Rosneft to drill in it had earned then-Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson the Russian Order of Friendship from Putin's own hand. The Pobeda oil field was estimated in 2014 to hold at least 130 million tons of oil, which in 2018 would be worth approximately $60 billion, about six times what Glencore and QIA paid to own 19.5% of Rosneft. 2 days after Kushner, Flynn, Bannon, Nader, and the Crown Prince of the United Arab Emirates meet secretly at Trump Tower on December 13, 2016, Trump nominates Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State, doing so while Carter Page is in Moscow meeting with Rosneft executives and on the same day Jared Kushner meets with the chief executive of VEB. By March 2018, the Trump administration is considering allowing Saudi Arabia to enrich uranium, a decision that could lead to the Middle Eastern nation handing out over $80 billion in construction contracts to build 16 nuclear reactors over the next 25 years. The United States, Russia, and China are slated to compete for these construction contracts. The Saudis could also seek the nuclear technology they need, however, from France, the United Kingdom, or even Russia, instead of the United States. In the end, that's exactly what the Saudis do. In August 2018, Haaretz writes, "Russia has staged a comeback in the Mideast, big time, to the extent that it may replace the United States as the leading foreign power in the region. Russia's success results from a combination of both deft diplomacy and weapons and nuclear reactor sales to states throughout the region." Haaretz adds, "Putin's fundamental strategic objective is to restore Russian global leadership." Improving diplomatic relations with Russia is important to both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, not merely because Russian construction firms may end up building any new nuclear reactors in the two countries. Far more important, both Saudi Arabia and the UAE are hoping that better relations with Russia will lead to a softening of Russia's support for two entities considered a potential threat to both Saudi and Emirati security: Iran and the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad, which is propped up by Iranian human, military, and financial resources. The Saudis and Emiratis are joined in their enmity for Iran and its puppet regimes by Israel. This fact helps explain why George Nader, representing the interests of the crown princes of both Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and Joel Zammel, an Israeli business intelligence entrepreneur with Israeli government connections, tell Trump Jr. on August 3, 2016, that all three nations have a vested interest in seeing Trump elected president. Influential Saudis, Emiratis, and Israelis offer assistance to the Trump campaign because they believe Trump, not Clinton, is willing to do the one thing that will bring Putin back to the table in the Middle East: drop all sanctions on Russia. The New Yorker will write in July 2018 that, before the November 2016 election, Mohammed bin Zayed, the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, floated to a long-time American interlocutor what sounded, at the time, like an unlikely grand bargain. The Emirati leader told the American that Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, might be interested in resolving the conflict in Syria in exchange for the lifting of sanctions imposed in response to Russia's actions in Ukraine. The magazine adds that while the idea of a rapprochement between Russia and the United States has long deeply unnerved America's European allies, three countries that in November 2016 enjoyed unparalleled influence with the incoming administration, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, have repeatedly encouraged their American counterparts to consider ending the Ukraine-related sanctions in return for Putin's help in removing Iranian forces from Syria. It is in the midst of this years-long saga involving Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Russia, Syria, and Iran that Eric Prince flies to the Seychelles to meet with representatives from the United Arab Emirates, and, at George Nader's orchestration on behalf of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, with Kirill Dmitriev from the Russian Direct Investment Fund. The QIA has just declined to loan Kushner hundreds of millions in much-needed money, allegedly angering Kushner. In the coming months, Kushner will convince Trump to support Saudi Arabia's blockade on the tiny Middle Eastern nation. The Saudi blockade will, by the end of 2017, help Kushner pressure Qatar into loaning him nearly $1 billion. In January 2017, however, what the Saudis and Emiratis most want from Trump is nuclear technology, specifically sales of same without a Section 123 agreement prohibiting the Saudis from ever weaponizing their uranium. The opportunity exists, should the United States assent to these sales, for all parties to get what they want: the Trumps, as much as $1 billion, the Russians, an end to sanctions, the Saudis and the UAE, nuclear reactors, an easing of Russian support for Iran, and the right to enrich uranium without prohibitions on its subsequent weaponization; Qatar, an end to the Saudi blockade, the favor of the Trump administration, and a very large, and likely to grow should sanctions on Russia end, private stake in Russia's state-owned oil company. In the Seychelles, prince, acting as a Trump representative, meets with the UAE's MBZ and Dmitriev, the latter not just the manager of Russia's $10 billion sovereign wealth fund, but also a man close to Vladimir Putin. The purpose of the meeting is to set up a back channel between President-elect Trump and Putin, roughly the same effort that Kushner and Kislyak had been working on in early December. Prince will say to CNN of the meeting that he was already in the Seychelles on unrelated business with Emirati officials when he met some fund manager. I can't even remember his name. Prince will tell CNN the meeting probably lasted about as long as one beer. In November 2017 testimony before the House Intelligence Committee, a confident, combative Prince, appearing without a lawyer, will say he had no official or unofficial role in the Trump campaign, though he will concede regularly sending and sometimes delivering in person national security and foreign policy white papers to campaign CEO Steve Bannon at Trump Tower. He will also say that, while in the Seychelles, the Emiratis he was already scheduled to meet with merely mentioned a guy I should meet who was also in town to see them, and who also ran some sort of hedge fund. He will agree, when asked, that the two men did discuss U.S.-Russia relations. As Trump fills out his cabinet, Prince's sister, Betsy DeVos, is nominated to be Secretary of Education, despite her being called uniquely unprepared, unqualified, and dangerous by U.S. News and World Report. Manifestly unqualified and woefully ignorant by the Washington Post, and unprepared and unqualified by the Los Angeles Times. In the end, DeVos is confirmed only when Vice President Pence casts the tie-breaking vote in the U.S. Senate, two Republicans having bolted from their caucus to vote against the nomination alongside Senate Democrats. Tillerson is successfully nominated for and confirmed as Secretary of State, despite the New York Times noting bipartisan concerns that the globe-trotting leader of an energy giant has a too cozy relationship with Vladimir V. Putin, the president of Russia. And Jeff Sessions, the chairman of Trump's National Security Advisory Committee, which included among its roster Carter Page, George Papadopoulos, J.D. Gordon, and Joseph Schmitz, is nominated to the post of attorney general, in part, Trump will later admit, because he assumed Sessions would protect him from any investigation into his family's, or the campaign's dealings with Russia. Sessions will run into problems after his successful confirmation, however, as he will be found to have provided inaccurate testimony under oath regarding his work as the National Security Advisory Committee's chairman. His controversial answers before the Senate Judiciary Committee, deliberately evasive at best and perjury at worst, will lead to his recusal from the Trump-Russia investigation in March 2017. On December 29th, the Obama administration levels new sanctions on Russia. Putin's decision not to retaliate against the new sanctions, his usual practice in such situations, raises concerns within the Obama administration that Russia has been promised an end to sanctions under the Trump presidency. Trump's immediate reaction to Putin's decision on Twitter, "Great move on delay by V. Putin," he tweets, adding, "I always knew he was very smart," does nothing to allay these concerns. The administration's fears soon prove justified, not only because Flynn was in fact holding policy discussions, possibly negotiations, with Sergei Kislyak before Election Day, and thereafter began, or continued, negotiating sanctions with Kislyak during the presidential transition, but also because, as is revealed in June 2017, Trump did indeed have a secret plan to drop all sanctions on Russia after his inauguration. On the day President Obama issues new sanctions on Russia, Flynn speaks to Russia's ambassador no fewer than 5 times by telephone, keeping in contact with K.T. McFarland at Mar-a-Lago between the calls. According to his December 2017 guilty plea for making false statements to the FBI, Flynn successfully convinces the Russians to refrain from retaliating against either Obama's imposition of new sanctions or the outgoing president's expulsion of 35 Russian diplomats from the United States. Just after the first of the year, a group of CIA officers meet with their counterparts from Mossad, Israel's primary intelligence agency, at Langley in Virginia. The CIA agents tell the Israelis that Trump is compromised by a foreign power, suffering under leverages of pressure. They warn the Israelis to be careful with intelligence sharing once Trump is in power. On January 6th, the U.S. intelligence community releases a joint FBI-CIA-NSA report, which concludes that Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered an influence campaign in 2016 aimed at the U.S. presidential election. Russia's goals were to undermine public faith in the U.S. democratic process, denigrate Secretary Clinton, and harm her electability and potential presidency. We further assess Putin and the Russian government developed a clear preference for President-elect Trump. We have high confidence in these judgments. In a statement that day, Trump refuses to accept the findings of the FBI, CIA, and NSA that Russia uniquely and discreetly attacked the 2016 presidential election, saying in part, "While Russia, China, other countries, outside groups, and people are consistently trying to break through the cyber infrastructure of our governmental institutions, businesses, and organizations, including the Democrat National Committee, there was absolutely no effect on the outcome of the election, including the fact that there was no tampering whatsoever with voting machines." On January 9, 2017, 11 days before Trump's inauguration, BuzzFeed publishes a now-famous 35-page dossier of raw intelligence compiled for a succession of anti-Trump Republicans and Democrats. The curator of the intelligence, an Englishman named Christopher Steele, is a former Russia desk head of the MI6. Numerous intelligence sources in England will vouch for his credibility and the quality of his sources when his work comes under fire almost immediately from Trump. Steele's dossier alleges that Trump aides coordinated with Kremlin agents throughout the 2016 general election season in a sanctions relief for money quid pro quo, coupled with active assistance from the Russians in attacking and undermining Hillary Clinton. Trump first learns of the dossier from his FBI director James Comey on January 6th. Comey tells Trump that he is not the subject of an open counterintelligence investigation, despite the dossier's allegations. On January 11th, less than 48 hours after BuzzFeed publishes the Steele dossier's allegations, Trump says, one of the only times he ever does so, as far as hacking, I think it was Russia. He quickly adds, however, but I think we also get hacked by other countries and other people. And then blames the Democrats for the hacking, saying, I have to say this also. The Democratic National Committee was totally open to be hacked. They did a very poor job. They could have had hacking defense, which we Republicans had. On the eve of Trump's inauguration, the New York Times reports that Comey's Trump-Russia investigation is much deeper and broader and uses more varied forms of evidence than had previously been suspected, noting that American law enforcement and intelligence agencies are examining intercepted communications and financial transactions as part of a broad investigation into possible links between Russian officials and associates of President-elect Donald J. Trump, including his former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort. The continuing counterintelligence investigation means that Mr. Trump will take the oath of office on Friday with his associates under investigation, and after the intelligence agencies concluded that the Russian government had worked to help elect him. The Times will also forecast logistically sensitive times ahead for both Trump and the nation, observing that Trump will oversee the very agencies that have concluded he benefited from Russian assistance, and will therefore have the authority to redirect or stop at least some of those efforts. This prescient comment presages and summarizes a central drama of the early months of the Trump presidency. Annotated History. Nevertheless, within 48 hours of Trump's November 8, 2016 election, Michael Flynn, who has no official role in the transition and has been denied a White House position by transition head Chris Christie, is cleared to contact Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's government without involvement by the State Department. It is unknown who gave him permission to make the contact. By the next day, at the direction of Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, Christie has been fired from the presidential transition team. He will openly speculate that his objection to Flynn's participation in the transition was a primary cause of his dismissal. According to the Washington Examiner, Jared Kushner's involvement in the firing of Christie was partly motivated by Christie's role in the prosecution of Jared's father, Charles Kushner. Trump went to extraordinary lengths to have Kushner named as one of his top advisors. To avoid anti-nepotism laws, Trump had to get an advisory opinion from the Department of Justice declaring the White House exempt from such regulations. Kushner spent the transition period building up his political capital in preparation for his new White House role, and his purge of the transition team, as the New York Times called it, was one of his first steps in further solidifying his position within Trump's political orbit. The Times wrote in November 2016, both former Congressman Mike Rogers and defense and foreign policy advisor Matthew Friedman were part of what officials described as a purge orchestrated by Jared Kushner. Mr. Kushner, a transition official said, was systematically dismissing people like Mr. Rogers who had ties with Mr. Christie. It was Christie's successful prosecution of Charles Kushner that had led indirectly to Jared Kushner's disastrous, nearly financially ruinous decision to purchase 666 Fifth Avenue in New York City. The purchase was Kushner's first major one after his father was incarcerated and Kushner took over Kushner Companies. According to NBC News, ever since the purchase of the property at 666 Fifth Avenue, Kushner Companies had been bleeding money. Several months after Trump's inauguration, around the time that Saudi Arabia's blockade on Qatar began, Charles Kushner met with a Qatari finance minister to discuss funding for 666 Fifth Avenue, a decision he later said was the wrong thing to do. Kushner defended his decision to attend the meeting, however, by saying that he met with a Qatari simply to tell him he couldn't accept any funding from Qatar while his son was assisting with U.S. Qatar policy in the White House. When asked by Business Insider why he didn't simply refuse the meeting in the first instance if he didn't intend to take any money from the Qataris, Kushner had no answer, except to agree that doing so would have been the right thing to do. Vice President Mike Pence immediately replaces Christie as the head of the transition team, even as Steve Bannon and Michael Flynn toss in the trash all the binders profiling potential administration nominees that Christie had been compiling. Pence will later say that he had no knowledge of what Flynn was planning to do, and ultimately did, with respect to covertly negotiating U.S. foreign policy with the Russians. On January 15, 2017, 5 days before Trump's inauguration, Pence told CBS's Face the Nation that Flynn and Kislyak had not discussed sanctions in December 2016. "It was strictly coincidental that they had a conversation," said Pence, the head of the presidential transition team. "They did not discuss anything having to do with the United States' decision to expel diplomats or impose censure against Russia." Pence's statement was ultimately found to be untrue, which forced the White House to say that either Flynn had lied to Pence or Pence had lied to the nation. It chose the former, and thereafter fired Flynn. Kushner, Flynn, Bannon, Nader, and the Crown Prince of the United Arab Emirates meet secretly at Trump Tower. 2 days later, on December 13, 2016, Trump nominates Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State, doing so while Carter Page is in Moscow meeting with Rosneft executives, and on the same day Jared Kushner meets with the chief executive of VEB. Something else Trump did on December 13th was to tell the Wall Street Journal he wanted to end all sanctions on Russia. Trump's campaign manager, cum presidential counselor Kellyanne Conway, repeated that sentiment 2 weeks later, just before Trump's first phone call with Vladimir Putin as President of the United States. On January 6th, the U.S. intelligence community releases a joint FBI-CIA-NSA report concluding that Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered an influence campaign in 2016 aimed at the U.S. presidential election. Russia's goals were to undermine public faith in the U.S. democratic process, denigrate Secretary Clinton, and harm her electability and potential presidency. We further assess Putin and the Russian government developed a clear preference for President-elect Trump. The new information in the report, which Trump was briefed upon several hours before it was published, was that Russia preferred Trump to Clinton. Trump had already been briefed on August 17, 2016, on the fact that U.S. intelligence had seen direct links between the Russian government and systemic interference with the 2016 presidential election. 3 days before the January 6, 2017 briefing, Trump took to Twitter to falsely claim that the briefing had originally been scheduled for January 3rd. He used the occasion of the briefing allegedly being moved back, which it was not, to try to discredit it in advance, tweeting, "The intelligence briefing on so-called Russian hacking was delayed until Friday, perhaps more time needed to build a case. Very strange." This was one of the earliest instances of Trump's casting doubt on U.S. law enforcement, not merely for its handling of the Clinton investigation, but its handling of the ongoing Russia investigation. It is a political strategy that would shortly become a hallmark of the new Trump presidency. Chapter 12. The Firings of Flynn and Comey, February to May 2017. Summary. As Donald Trump enters office, the collusion question no longer centers on Trump's securing the White House through a clandestine quid pro quo, but something altogether different. A collaborative effort by Trump and his aides, allies, and associates to obscure what has been done and by whom, mostly by seeking to control or derail federal law enforcement's fast-expanding investigation into the matter. For Trump, the most immediate dilemma is National Security Advisor and one-time VP shortlister Michael Flynn, who was acting on orders from Jared Kushner and possibly others in negotiating with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak during the transition, but now must be removed from his job before the scandal over his actions deepens. From the moment Flynn is fired, Trump is engaged in an effort to convince or compel FBI Director James Comey to end the Flynn investigation and to clear Trump himself of any wrongdoing relating to Russia. The new president fires Sally Yates, the Obama holdover acting attorney general, and also the attorney who brought Flynn's actions to the attention of law enforcement, and seeks to maintain Flynn's loyalty to him through a clandestine outreach. Meanwhile, the December 9, 2016 handoff of the Steele dossier from Senator John McCain to James Comey, McCain having received it from a retired British diplomat, Sir Andrew Wood, at an annual security conference in Nova Scotia in mid-November 2016, has launched a new phase of the FBI's counterintelligence investigation of Russian election meddling. This new phase puts Trump and several of his aides and associates in the crosshairs of federal law enforcement as chief figures in the dossier. When a man strongly suspected by investigators of being one of Steele's sources is apparently murdered in Moscow, U.S. and foreign journalists suggest that this lends credence to some of the intelligence Steele has compiled. When Comey refuses to publicly clear Trump of any wrongdoing, his job is immediately placed in jeopardy. He is fired by Trump on May 9th, less than 90 days after Flynn is removed from his position. During those 90 days, an event occurs, however, that will make Trump's firing of Comey the most problematic decision of his presidency. Facing accusations of lying to Congress, Trump's Attorney General Jeff Sessions recuses himself from the ongoing Trump-Russia investigation in early March. Sessions's recusal from the Russia probe, followed by Comey's firing, opens the door for Rod Rosenstein, the acting Attorney General for the Russia investigation, to appoint Robert Mueller as special counsel. Rosenstein's appointment of Mueller, authorizing the former FBI director to investigate any coordination or links between the Russian government and individuals associated with the Trump campaign, as well as any crimes that might arise from the investigation of that question, comes under new Department of Justice regulations. The old ones had lapsed when the independent counsel statute expired after the last major investigation of a president, Kenneth Starr of Bill Clinton. Mueller moves quickly to continue the work Comey had started, even as a series of sluggish and highly partisan congressional investigations begin interviewing a few of the key witnesses in the Trump-Russia case. In Washington, D.C., Trump exhibits increasingly unusual behavior, urging the White House counsel to lobby Sessions to unrecuse himself, disclosing classified Israeli intelligence to Kremlin agents in the Oval Office, accusing President Obama, without any proof, of wiretapping his Trump Tower office, and finally, firing Comey, an act he brags about to Kremlin agents and then admits in an interview with NBC's Lester Holt was an attempt to stifle the Russia investigation. This fuels speculation that far more of the Steele dossier may be accurate than anyone had previously realized. While media will point out that the dossier is unverified and Trump will call it fake and sick, as the first 120 days of the Trump presidency comes to a close, there is substantial evidence to suggest the FBI is using Christopher Steele's compilation of human intelligence as a roadmap for understanding Trump-Russia collusion prior to Election Day. The facts. FBI Director James Comey briefs Trump on the Steele dossier 2 weeks before Trump's inauguration. He will later testify before Congress that he immediately memorialized his briefing of Trump based on the president-elect's reaction to hearing the information in the dossier and because, as he later said, "I was honestly concerned that he might lie about the nature of our meeting." 2 days after his inauguration, Trump will single out Comey during a public event and attempt to embrace him in front of a bank of cameras. According to a friend of Comey's who was told the story later on by the former FBI director, Comey was disgusted. He regarded the episode as a physical attempt to show closeness and warmth in a fashion calculated to compromise him before Democrats who already mistrusted him. 5 days later, Trump invites Comey to dinner at the White House. According to former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, who spoke to Comey before the dinner, Comey was uneasy with it, both from a standpoint of the optic of compromising his independence and the independence of the FBI. At dinner, Trump does several things that communicate a preoccupation with the Russian collusion allegations he knows the FBI is then investigating. For instance, he asks Comey, who was working under a long-term cross-administration appointment, whether he wants to remain the FBI director, which Comey will later say seemed like an effort to have me ask for my job and create some sort of patronage relationship. Trump demands an oath of loyalty from Comey immediately after Comey tells him the FBI needs to remain independent, saying, "I need loyalty. I expect loyalty," and then repeating, "I need loyalty," at the end of the dinner. And Trump is so attentive to the details of the Steele dossier, which he claims is both false and offensive, that per Comey, he said he was considering ordering me to investigate the alleged incident at the Ritz-Carlton in Moscow 2013 to prove it didn't happen, though he never follows up on the idea. In a May 2017 interview on Fox News, Trump will use the sort of vacillatory, self-exculpating phrasing he had previously used with respect to Michael Flynn. "I didn't direct him to discuss sanctions with the Russian ambassador, but I would have directed him because that's his job," he'd declared on the Flynn matter, by saying to Jeanine Pirro, "I didn't ask Comey for his loyalty, but I don't think it would be a bad question to ask. As Trump is attempting to build a relationship with Comey that would make continued investigation of him by the FBI less likely, he is also dealing with a growing crisis involving his national security adviser. 4 days after Trump's inauguration, Michael Flynn is interrogated by the FBI on suspicion of having illegally negotiated U.S. foreign policy with a hostile foreign power prior to Trump taking office. That Flynn had spoken to Kislyak around the time Putin decided not to retaliate for the new sanctions imposed by Obama was clear by January 12th. However, Vice President-elect Mike Pence, who was the transition head, had told CBS 3 days later that Flynn and Kislyak did not discuss anything having to do with the United States' decision to expel diplomats or impose censure against Russia. When Flynn dissembles with the FBI on January 24th, telling agents he never discussed sanctions with the Russians, which the FBI knows is untrue as it has telephonic intercepts indicating otherwise, Acting Attorney General Sally Yates, an Obama holdover fulfilling her role until Sessions is confirmed, will go to the White House to tell White House counsel Don McGahn that the nation's national security adviser may be compromised by a foreign power. Yates's fear is that if the Russians know Flynn hasn't told the FBI the truth, they can exert leverage over him via a threat to disclose to federal law enforcement what he really said and did. Yates also wants McGahn to know that Flynn has been dishonest with White House officials about his calls to Kislyak, an assumption she makes because the White House has said publicly that no one on the transition team discussed sanctions with the Russians. Instead of treating Flynn's potential compromising by Russia as an emergency, McGahn asks Yates why the Department of Justice cares about the issue. When Yates repeats that Flynn is now susceptible to blackmail by a foreign power, McGahn demands to see all the evidence the Department of Justice has compiled on Flynn. Yates agrees to provide the evidence by January 30th. Trump fires her that day. According to subsequent comments by White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, at the time Trump fired Yates, he had been fully briefed on the fact that she was correct. Flynn had indeed lied about his discussions to the FBI, and ostensibly to certain officials in the Trump administration. It is later revealed that then-President Obama warned Trump against hiring Flynn 2 days after the 2016 election, the same 48-hour span in which Chris Christie was issuing his own warning on Flynn. Trump instead hired Flynn as his national security adviser on November 17th, less than a week after both Obama and Christie had strongly advised him not to do so. Within 24 hours, a Democratic congressman, Representative Elijah Cummings, Democrat Maryland, had written transition head Mike Pence demanding more details on Flynn's unregistered lobbying for both Turkey and Russia, the latter of which Flynn had been working for through the Kremlin-funded propaganda network RT. Cummings will later discover and make public that Flynn did not disclose on his federal security clearance forms a trip he took to the Middle East to lobby for nuclear power plant sales the very month Trump announced his presidential run. He will find, too, that Flynn failed to report several contacts with Israeli and Egyptian governmental officials, two nations with whom George Papadopoulos also had substantial contact during the campaign. Notably, Flynn will be the next Trump campaign advisor charged with a crime after Papadopoulos becomes a cooperating government witness in July 2017. In the final few days of Flynn's tenure as national security advisor, the Kremlin attempts to pass a sanctions relief proposal to Flynn, framed as a peace deal for Ukraine, through a Kremlin-allied Ukrainian politician, Andriy V. Artemenko. Artemenko meets with Trump business partner Felix Sater and Trump attorney and fixer Michael Cohen. At the meeting, he hands them an envelope with the Kremlin-approved anti-sanctions proposal inside. The envelope later ends up on Flynn's desk. Cohen at first acknowledges bringing the envelope to the White House and giving it to Flynn, and then changes his story and says he had no interest in what Artemenko was selling and told the Ukrainian to mail his proposal to the White House by regular mail if he wanted to contact President Trump. For reasons that are never made clear, after Trump is told in late January by his White House counsel that Flynn has had conversations about sanctions with the Russian ambassador, he, according to the White House version of events, waits 2 weeks to tell Pence that Flynn lied to him. Throughout this 2-week period, Trump knows that his national security adviser has been compromised by the Russians, but he allows him to maintain his security clearance. When questions are raised in the months ahead about why Flynn's security clearance wasn't revoked on January 27th, Trump will blame Obama for having given Flynn a security clearance in the first instance. Flynn resigns, or is fired, depending upon whom one asks, 96 hours after Pence is officially informed, if he did not already know, that Flynn lied about his calls to Kislyak. On March 9th, when Flynn's lobbying for Turkey becomes national news, Pence will say he is hearing about it for the first time. As for the date on which Trump first heard about the Flynn-Kislyak calls, that fact has not yet been established. It is confirmed by Fox News, however, that at some point prior to Flynn's firing, Trump is fully briefed on what his national security adviser said to Kislyak, including Flynn's statement to the Russian ambassador in contravention of the Logan Act that the Kremlin could expect a reprieve from the sanctions announced by then-President Obama on December 29, 2016. Nevertheless, on February 16th, just 72 hours after Flynn's firing, Trump will say at a press conference, "Mike was doing his job. I would have directed him to do it if I thought he wasn't doing it. I didn't direct him, but I would have directed him because that's his job." Trump's claim that he believed Flynn was discussing sanctions policy with the Russians in late December, coupled with his denial that he specifically ordered the negotiations, does not include a concurrent denial that he had knowledge of the negotiations as they were happening. A key issue for Trump following Flynn's exit is the question of how many of his former aides, allies, and associates will cooperate with the quickly evolving FBI probe of potential Trump-Russia collusion. On March 30th, Flynn takes the extraordinary step of publicly offering to testify before Congress in exchange for immunity from prosecution. His attorney will tell the media that Flynn certainly has a story to tell. Congress rebuffs his offer in under a day. It cannot in any case immunize him against possible prosecution by the special counsel. Shortly thereafter, Trump calls Flynn and tells him to stay strong. Almost immediately, Flynn ceases to cooperate with congressional investigators, ignoring a subpoena in mid-May. The same month, Carter Page reveals that he is cooperating with Senate investigators and is eager to continue doing so. By then, it has already been revealed that Jared Kushner has volunteered to be questioned by Congress. Meanwhile, Trump's son, Don Jr., gives an interview in which he is asked whether he had any campaign-related meetings with Russian nationals pre-election. "Did I meet with people that were Russian? I'm sure," Trump Jr. responds, then adds, "But none that were set up, none that I can think of at the moment, and certainly none that I was representing the campaign in any way, shape, or form." On May 8th, former Acting Attorney General Yates, under questioning from Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat, Connecticut, repeatedly refuses to publicly rule out Trump as a potential target of the FBI's ongoing counterintelligence investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. At his testimony in June, James Comey, fired by Trump on May 9th, 6 days after he refuses to rule out Trump as a target in the Russia investigation, and one day after Yates likewise refuses to do so, will tell Congress what happened between him and Trump the day after Flynn's February 13th firing. According to Comey, he went to the Oval Office the day after Flynn's firing for a scheduled briefing, after which the president asked him to stay behind. Comey was hoping Sessions would prevent Trump from seeking a one-on-one audience with the FBI director, but Sessions left the room when Trump asked him to do so. Thereafter, Trump said to Comey, in Comey's paraphrase, "I want to talk about Mike Flynn." The president began by saying Flynn hadn't done anything wrong in speaking with the Russians, but he had to let him go because he had misled the vice president. He added that he had other concerns about Flynn, which he did not then specify. He is a good guy, and has been through a lot. He then said, I hope you can see your way clear to letting this go, to letting Flynn go. He is a good guy. I hope you can let this go. Comey will add that because of the setting and the fact that Trump asked to see him alone, he took the president's words as a directive. Trump's attempts to derail the FBI investigation into his campaign's ties with Russia are unusually direct, forceful, and persistent. In addition to